Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Hercules and the Space Gods. I am Hercules Invictus, and tonight I am proud to bring you Nick Curto Presents the Urantia Book. His guest is Carol Cannon, and they'll be exploring the Urantia Book and other spiritual paths. Greetings and welcome, Nick Curto. How are you, sir?
Oh, very well, Hercules. We're very well indeed. The horrible, hot, humid weather in New York City has gone down about maybe 18 degrees, and I am one happy camper right now, let me tell you that.
Me too. It got cool enough for us to open the windows and close the air conditioner, so that was a good thing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And fall is just around the corner, so stay tuned.
I most certainly will. Your guest is here, and I'm looking forward to your show. If you need me, just holler.
Will do. Thank you so much. Hercules, you are the best producer anyone could ever dream to have. I totally mean that. To all our listeners out there, a very warm welcome. This is Nick Curto Presents the Urantia Book, which is a live 60-minute podcast. I'm Nick Curto, your host. A very brief background about yours truly. I now live in Manhattan and have lived here for a good part of my life. I was born and raised in New England, Springfield, Massachusetts, to be precise. I went to the Massachusetts College of Art and Design in Boston, was president of the Newman Club and the Drama Club, and after graduation, I headed directly to New York City to begin my advertising and design career, and also, and this is important, to continue to explore my ongoing spiritual search, as well as other big questions about life that we all have and really do want answered. Now, I first heard of the Urantia Book after attending every Sunday morning the All Souls Unitarian Church that's located in Manhattan's Upper East Side on Lexington Avenue, about 79th Street, for a solid 2 years. When the minister for that last reading that particular Sunday morning read a few paragraphs at the very end of the service from a work titled The Urantia Book. It was very deeply resonating to me right from the very beginning. And that's a huge understatement. I felt that I had hit by a truly cutting-edge spiritual truck, but in a very wonderful sort of way. It was a very powerful, game-changing moment for me. I wanted to find out much more about the book that he had been reading. It was truly a masterwork in every way, and I had never experienced anything quite like that before. Remember repeating the title of the book in my mind all the way back home as I walked home that Sunday morning. So I could remember the title and write it down when I got home so I could remember it and then look it up later, which, of course, I did. I soon found a wonderful Urantia Book study group in Manhattan's Soho area. At the time, it was hosted by now my very, very dear friends, Robin and Helene Jorgensen. And I have been studying the Urantia Book now for over 35 years and counting. It's been a truly expansive, breathtaking experience for me to explore this truly inspiring, eye-opening, mind-expanding, and here it is, truly loving book that is called The Fifth Epical Revelation. The word Urantia means our planet Earth. That's interesting in itself. And it really gets very much deeply into large concepts of advanced truth. The book unites religion, science, philosophy, and is unique among literature, and it's claimed to be presented by celestial beings. Among other topics, the book discusses the origin and meaning of life, mankind's place in the universe, the relationship between God and all people and other beings in the universe, and the entire life of Jesus, which is a huge amount of information that is not revealed anywhere, including the Bible, or any other works that certainly I know of. You feel that you were there with him throughout his life and beyond. It's a big book indeed, with 2,098 pages, so it's a very large book. I'm a longtime member of the Urantia Society of Greater New York, made up of UB readers from New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. And I've been the past president, vice president, outreach chair, and those are some of my positions I've held there through the years. And currently, I'm on the outreach committee to publicize the Urantia book. Now, up until the COVID hit, I hosted the Urantia Book Study Group in Manhattan in the West Village, sponsored by the Urantia Society of Greater New York, that met the first and third Sundays of each month throughout the year at the LGBTQ Center on West 13th Street in New York City. I very much miss that wonderful group, and I hope and pray that we'll be able to meet again face-to-face very, very soon. Some of us now get together on a Zoom Urantia Book Study Group, a meeting every Tuesday night, and it's hosted by my dear friend Carol Cannon, who incidentally is a longtime Urantia Book reader, as well as my featured guest for tonight's program. The Urantia Book has been translated into 28 world languages, with many more on the way. It's sold in better bookstores worldwide. And you can also read and also listen to the entire book on the internet. I'm going to give you two websites to do just that. The first one is www.urantiabook.org. The second one is www.urantia.nyc. They're both excellent websites, beautifully designed, and you can find a wealth of material in there. Okay, let's get right to it. My dear friend and colleague, Carol Cannon, a very warm welcome to you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Nick. I appreciate your inviting me to be your guest, and I appreciate Hercules' role in, you know, allowing us to have these airwaves during this time, this hour. And I want to sort of say or wave hello to our fellow Urantia Book readers from our Tuesday night study group, if there's any of them on listening. Hello! And everybody else.
Oh, that's wonderful, Carol. I've been so looking forward to having you back on the program. You've been here once before. I'm going to ask you a few key questions just to get the listeners who haven't heard you on the other program that you did for us a while back, but I just want to go quickly through that, and then we'll get right to the material at hand. So may I ask you first, where do you now make your home?
I live in Astoria, New York, just outside of Manhattan. I can actually see the New York skyline, the Empire State Building, from where I sit out my window.
Excellent. Now, I want to tell the listeners that you are a longtime reader of the Urantia Book. You have also studied many other spiritual teachings and have a clear understanding of what one each offers, the truth seeker or truth seekers, and what the differences are in the various works. You have compared many of the spiritual outlooks, and you do a very, very clear job of explaining them. You have been raised as an artist. You studied and taught on the emerging field of energy psychology since 1997, trained and served as an interfaith minister, Reiki master, EFT practitioner, resonant repatterning practitioner, and Carol employs clients and empowers clients and audiences with self-understanding and self-healing for greater self-expression and joy. And wow, Carol, that's quite a background there already. Really good for you. That's quite a lot on your plate. Now,
well,
I'd like
you know,
to ask you. Go ahead.
I was just going to explain that, you know, all of those healing modalities are things that, you know, I really intently wanted to practice. But as time has gone on, I've just been really busy supporting myself as a decorative painter. But I'm glad that I, you know, was certified in all those disciplines and can pull them out of my bag of tricks when anybody needs or wants the help. But, you know, I'm not actually actively practicing those anymore unless somebody just suddenly wants to do an EFT session or a resonance repatterning session, et cetera.
Right, right. But I think by going into those various, very amazing areas, that all is like connecting the dots, because every one of them, I'm sure, has given you insight. And, of course, that all does add up. And I was really very impressed with that particular list that I read when you submitted that to me, because really that's a lot of very different areas. And to go into those areas, and I think that's quite wonderful that you did that.
Well, thank you. Well, maybe later on I can explain some of that, but you go ahead with your questions.
Okay, I'm going to go quickly through this and just ask a few general questions right now. First of all, let's start off with, where were you born and raised?
I was born in the White Plains Hospital. My parents lived in Tarrytown, New York, and then when I just turned 5, we moved up to Ridgefield, Connecticut, where I spent the rest of my youth, and then after high school, moved to Boulder, basically spent 2 years there in Colorado, and then came to New York to study art, and I've been here ever since 1975.
Wow. Now, I beat you because I came here after I graduated from the Massachusetts College of Art and Design in 1966, so I beat you a few years there. But what a great city. What a great city to be alive and to take part in all that's here. It's really such an amazing environment. I have always loved being here, and I think that it was a great choice to make. Now, I just got to ask you, brothers and sisters, Carol, in your family?
I have an older brother who still lives in Boulder, Colorado, and a younger sister who lives in Scituate, Massachusetts.
Excellent. And were your mom and dad at all spiritual? And if so, what denomination?
I have to say they were not particularly. My mother's side prided herself on being first an atheist and then evolved to an agnostic. And then my father, when I asked him if he believed in God when I was 16 and sort of going through my own spiritual crisis, he said, well, you know what they say in the war, that there are no atheists in foxholes. So that was sort of the extent of their spirituality. That's why I think that I had such a thirst, because there was none of that in my family. There was sort of a token gesture to take my brother and I to Sunday school when we were very young a couple of times, but that never got any traction. So I really had to start seeking on my own in my young teens, my early teens.
You're searching on your own at that point. Good for you. Good for you to take that effort to search for what was meaningful. Just quickly, how did you come across the Arantia book, please?
Oh, yes. Well, when I was 15, I had a very close girlfriend, Sue Durkee, in Ridgefield, Connecticut, and we used to do everything together, ride and went to school together, and we didn't live too far apart, so we could actually ride our horses to each other's house in the back roads. So she had a brother that was 2 years older, and he and I used to get into conversations about the meaning of life, and then he took a trip to Sweden to visit this young woman who had been an au pair for their family. And he discovered the Urantia book on the coffee table of this apartment in Sweden, and read the book entirely in 3 months. And when he came back, he introduced me to the book, and I went down to Samuel Weiser's bookstore on West 23rd at the time, and bought myself a copy, and had the great fortune to have the wisdom to buy the Concordex, which is like an index that helped me look up the specific questions I had, because the book was so overwhelming. I really didn't know how to get my mind around it initially. So he introduced it to me. It took me a lot longer to read it than he did, but little by little, I really began to grasp the scope and the depth of the book, and then I couldn't put it down and have been reading it ever since.
Excellent. And you mentioned the Concordex. Now, that is still available, is it?
You know, I'd have to check. I imagine that they have to keep printing that, even though I know there's an index that's now available. I have always defended the increased value of the Concordix because it gives you a little phrase under the topic or the subtopic that you're looking for, so you know exactly what aspect of that topic that you're looking up. And so you can learn a lot just by looking at the Concordix.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more. And at one point, I asked you if I could borrow it, which you very wonderfully loaned me your Concordix. And you were absolutely right. It's a treasure chest of information that relates to the Rancho book. And absolutely, if people want to get very deep into the book, to take a look at the Concordix to try to buy that would also be highly, highly recommended. Okay, well, with that, we're going to go right to our main subject tonight, Carol, and I'm going to ask you where you would like to begin.
Before you guys start your subject, there's some reverb on Carol's line. Carol, are you near a computer or another phone system?
No, but I do have a headset on. Maybe I should take my headset off and just speak directly into the phone.
Let's try that. Thank you.
Is this any better?
100%. Thank you. Sorry.
Oh, I'm so sorry for that.
Well, not at all. Sometimes we have to find out how thing best works. So, but no, you're very clear. I can hear every word. So why don't we ask you where you would like to start? I mean, the subject is quite interesting, comparing the Rancho book with other works. So please go right ahead.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate your openness to this topic because some people, when they discover the Urantia book, you know, that's it, their home. It satiates all their need to, you know, discover truth because it's endless. You know, the knowledge in the Urantia book, you know, you could just read it, just endless amounts of time, and there's no ending of our capacity to absorb the truth that's in, you know, practically every sentence. But I don't know why, just being sort of a restless soul, I, you know, did a lot of searching before I had discovered the Urantia book and continued to do a lot of searching after discovering it, although it has always proven to be sort of the pièce de résistance, you know, the top of the pinnacle of sources. But there have been a lot of other sources that have supplemented my desire to, you know, really find peace with myself. And, you know, I just have accepted that I am fundamentally a seeker. I'll never stop, you know, exploring new paths to help me really experience, you know, not only God's presence, but, you know, a deeper, true sense of myself. I know, in very early years, I guess when I was like 13 or 14, I did kind of believe that there was this Buddhist concept that we could become self-realized, that we could, you know, actually achieve enlightenment in this one single lifetime. And I was determined to do everything I could to achieve that. But then when it didn't seem to be working out so well, I was somewhat reassured in the Urantia book that, you know, we have many, many, many opportunities going forward from this lifetime on, not necessarily to reincarnate on this planet, but to go, you know, sort of upward and into more refined realms and have, you know, many, many incarnations in finer and finer versions of ourselves to, you know, really come to know God and to be of service and to completely, I think, express our unlimited potential. But I think one of the points I wanted to make initially in this talk was that the Urantia helps us understand there's a distinction between evolved religion and revealed religion. And basically, the evolved religion, it's motivated by, you know, mankind's early need to understand mysteries and to deal with his fears and to try to make sense if there's any kind of an afterlife. And so there was an assignment of a lot of, you know, superstitions and, you know, various deities and whatnot. And so we today still have the remnants of a lot of evolved religion. And then we have the gifts of what Urantia Book calls revealed religion. And when I was just looking this up earlier today, I could always run and get the book and read this quote, but they list five revelations on this planet. I won't go into them now, but as you said in the introduction, Nick, that the Urantia Book describes itself as the fifth epochal, meaning, you know, during specific long-term epochs, that the book itself is a revelation. The revelations in the past have come in the form of beings like Christ himself was the fourth epochal revelation. The book described itself as the fifth one, and it's somewhat unusual that it's in the book form. It's actually the word made flesh, so to speak, in terms of the word made book. But I only point that out because I think that's when I became really intrigued by the idea of, you know, in a sense, I don't like to use the word either, but there's no other term, but channeled material like Edgar Cayce or the Saint Germain teachings, the I Am teachings. A recent one that our friend Tom Garber has also begun to explore are the 17 volumes of a Dr. Masaharu Taniguchi, who started the Truth of Life back in the 1930s when he too was lucky enough to sort of the microphone of this higher intelligence that was able to, in a sense, dictate very clear explanations of, you know, what our purpose is and how we have been led astray and how the way out of this darkness is. And so, you know, I've gone from sort of one version to another, and you know, I'm always wondering, well, what could be next? But I always come back to the Urantia Book. I always try to read the Urantia Book simultaneously because it just doesn't ever, you know, there's no ending to the absorbing of its magnitude. I don't know if your listeners are predominantly readers or they're new to the book, but anyway, maybe I will just pause and say, before we end the conversation, I was hoping that I could share with the listeners something that I heard just last night. It was actually Thursday night. There is a gentleman who has been a scholar of myths from the time that he was 15. Somehow his grandmother tried to get him a book on history, and somehow he got the wrong book, and it was on mythology, and then that was just the determining of his entire life's trajectory. And he shared a story on Thursday night's almost a two-hour program that I just thought would be beautiful to share. And it's interesting because it doesn't come from anything channeled. It doesn't come from, you know, any kind of revealed, did I say the other one was, evolutionary religion. But it comes from myth and imagination, but it has such impact in terms of the truth. Maybe I should just go ahead and share it, unless you'd like to stop me, Nick, and re-guide
you
this direction.
No, you have. I believe you have my interest and everyone's interest right now. So please go ahead. This is quite good. Yeah.
Okay. All righty. And then maybe I'll go back and make a couple other points. And, you know, in my effort to try to be prepared for tonight, I also started making a list of all the gifts that the Urantia Book has given me. So that might be the topic of another night. But anyway, so this story that Michael Meade, M-E-A-D-E, shared, you know, he was specifically addressing the echo crisis that we all find ourselves witnessing. And especially since the latest report from the Intergovernmental Climate Change Group put out through the UN. And it was so discouraging because, you know, the urgency of it is even greater. And yet the will seems to be lacking to really take the measures that need to be taken to stop us from exceeding the temperature that would just put us, you know, on a pathway to, you know, extinction. But Michael Mead felt that in order to particularly reach out to the youth, because can you imagine being a young person today and, you know, witnessing the news and witnessing the gnosis for the planet, and just wonder, you know, what could one really do? I mean, it would really, I think, sap all the hope out of me, because I was, you know, I was depressed back in the 60s because of the way things looked, and I can't imagine, you know, what I would feel now without a source of inspiration. So this Michael Mead,
I couldn't agree with you more. The challenge now is even much more severe than when I was younger and facing the world. And I totally get what you just said. It's very important.
Well, it was so beautiful because this man, you know, I really encourage everybody to look him up, Michael Mead, because he had such a grasp of the situation and of people and human nature and how to inspire. And he spoke about, you know, the fact that we really need a collective vision. And this is something that I think the Urantia book has always, you know, has provided for me, and I've always wished that this is something that I could share with a lot of people, is that the explanation that the Urantia book gives about any kind of a normal planet that evolves, it you know, the ultimate destiny is to be in a stage of something called light and life, you know, where we have addressed disease and we have, you know, been able to subdue war through, you know, the motivation to keep a global peace. And it just, you know, and so this is within the reach of our species, but we need to understand there is a path towards that. And the Urantia book really spells it out. But this man shared a beautiful myth, and let me tell it now. And I've never, you know, read it or told it. I'm just sharing what I was able to remember what he shared, but old woman in the cave. And she was weaving the fabric of the world. And she was weaving this beautiful garment. And yet there was the pot in the back of the cave, and she had to get up and she had to go stir the pot because that was what was keeping the world turning. And she, you know, was stirring. And then when she came back, she saw that the big dog from outside the cave had come in and seen there was a loose thread and started playing with her weaving and had untied and unraveled and tangled the entire garment that she was weaving, this beautiful garment she was weaving for the world. And, you know, she, of course, was initially shocked. And then she saw that there was a single thread that she could start to repair the garment with. And then she suddenly became aware of an entirely new and more spectacular vision for the new garment that she started to weave. And so the dog actually did her and the world a great service, because there was going to be an even more stunning garment for the world to wear. And so, you know, this is the type of myth that this man believes, you know, people could be inspired in young people, because what everyone needs to know is, what is your thread in this weaving, in this garment? Like, what thread do we each, you know, embody in order to make this beautiful garment, you know, real? And so, you know, if I was a young person, I would have to think long and hard, you know, am I really a thread of any importance in this garment? And if this myth has any truth to it, because obviously it's something that's been handed down through, you know, different cultures, you know, I have to trust that there's wisdom in it. And, you know, maybe I would be more motivated to find out what is it that really impassions my heart, what is it that is my purpose that would help the garment hold together. And so I just thought that was beautiful. And, you know, this man, while he gave his presentation, he also quoted some beautiful poetry and actually chanted this American Indian chant. And you know, it was just such a holistic presentation that I thought, oh my goodness, here is an elder, here is a true man of wisdom who is, you know, his life purpose is just, you know, shedding light left and right. And so I'm going to be, you know, trying to follow his talks in the future. But before our time is completely out, I wanted to say one of the sources, even though the Urantia book has, you know, given me such solace and such inspiration, you know, such a deeper connection with, you know, what I believe is my higher power or my God, there still have been things in my own psyche or psychology that weren't resolved or weren't healed. And I found, you know, the 12-step programs as a path that really supplemented any of the missing aspects of the Urantia book in terms of, for example, 3 is made a decision to turn my life and my will over to the care of a power greater than myself. And so if I can live in that step 3 where I am saying, okay, you know, I know that there's a greater intelligence that encompasses and even comprises me. And if I am deliberately and consciously turning my will to that greater intelligence, things can only go better. And I, you know, that in a way is an invitation for it to work through me. And so that is one of the most helpful steps that I have gleaned from the 12-step program. But I also want to just mention one more before, and I'll let anybody else bring come up for air, is the book that Dr. Johan Kalman, he's a Swedish biologist who used to work for the World Health Organization. He was a cancer researcher. He took a sabbatical and went down to, I think it was Guatemala, and had some extraordinary experience in the pyramids. And when he came back, he started researching the Mayan calendar. And he, as is characteristic of his particular mentality, he is just so thorough and unrelenting in his research that he went above and beyond anybody else's research with the significance of the Mayans' understanding of time. They were really students of time, and not just human time, but cosmic time. And unlike what sort of the collective understanding is that the Mayan calendar ended in 2012, that was just a phase that ended. And what really started in 2011 was the beginning of what he describes as the ninth wave, which if you were looking at the way these frequencies operate in our solar system, it was the beginning of an emission of a new frequency which resonates this unconditional love. And the human brain is wired to be able to resonate with this frequency. And it's unconditional love, and it would allow our psyches to act and make decisions out of unconditional love for one another. And however, the previous waves, 1 through 8, that have been based on duality, which is basically perpetuates the illusion of me and you being separate, you know, us and them, and sets up a conflictual state of survival of the fittest, those waves are still echoing. They're still carrying on. They're still humans that resonate with these more, less evolved. And so Dr. Kalman was able to plot the sine waves, you know, the peaks and the valleys of these cycles of frequencies. And he was able to plot out, you know, what the Mayans called the days and the nights. The days are the sine waves that go above the horizon line, and the nights are those that sink below a certain frequency. And we are obviously in a night period. And in September, we're going to be reaching basically, you know, the base of the wave. And so we have, you know, things to look forward to. But he says it's not until 2031 that we are going to be back into the day cycle. And so that helped me so much because I've been living most of my life thinking and anticipating that we would witness humanity's transformation, that all of the spiritual awakening that was taking place in the turn of the 1900s, you know, all of these different sources, whether it was the Urantia book or the I Am teachings or the Theosophical Society or Edgar Cayce, I mean, all of these sources were stimulated then, and it seemed to me to think that we were going to, in our lifetimes, witness this turnaround. But according to this deeper understanding of cosmic waves, we may not witness this real shift, or at least visibly, in terms of our society until 2031. But even the Urantia book says, you know, don't let us think that we cannot individually experience those, you know, much higher, much more, you know, unified states of mind in our individual lives. And it's those, that group of people that are resonating with that unified field of unconditional love that is going to have the momentum and the radiation and the, you know, pebble, you know, the pebble in the pond effect, the ripple effect that is going to help us, you know, continue despite the way the news and, you know, the collective humanity's vision may be at this point. So, you know, I just continue to try to stay in touch with these sources to keep my own spirit up and, of course, to keep, you know, daily spiritual connection with, you know, what I believe is, you know, my higher power, my higher self, and just keep trying to put one foot in front of the next. So
well,
really
well said. Very well said, Carol.
And
I, well said, and I absolutely understand what you're saying here. It's really true. You know, a while back I wrote a song called "Limitless Love." So unconditional love, limitless love. They're beautiful concepts, and really what to shoot for. And when you experience, if you're blessed enough to experience in this lifetime, a limitless love or unconditional love, that is such a privilege and such a moving experience. And I only wish that everyone in this planet, past, present, and future, could experience that, because it really sets the pace of your whole life and your thinking of what you are, your connection to God, the Universal Father, however you want to phrase that, and you also your relationship with your fellow beings, not only on this planet, but others, brothers and sisters too. So it really gives you quite a lot to contemplate. But very well said, Carol. And just one other point, you were talking about looking deeply at of other spiritual writings and practices, and I have done a little bit of that myself, and I can honestly tell you that it was worth every second to do that, and very rich and rewarding experiences do happen when you ask people about their belief system and where they are reading, what they're doing with their lives, and what energies are they looking for, and where have they found guidance. So those are key questions that we all need to explore throughout our whole life. So totally get what you just said, and thank you for saying that.
Oh, sure. Yes, and it's what's really, you know, the reason why I pursued that energy psychology direction was because I began to realize that our nervous system, you know, the human body is wired to experience that unconditional, limitless love. And, you know, the fact that we are not taught as children or young adults how to work with our nervous system, you know, how to understand the breath and to understand the energy centers and to understand how, you know, we are electromagnetic, you know, bioenergetic antennae, you know, that are both receiving and sending signals all the time. And so, you know, it would be wonderful. And I know it's true that, you know, some more progressive communities are teaching children, you know, certain disciplines like Reiki so they can learn how to, you know, manage their stress and, you know, help them feel better. But it can also, you know, there's so much potential in that direction. But, you know, that was the exciting thing, is that, no, we're not supposed to necessarily leave the body. We're supposed to be in the body and to understand the body's role in this, you know, experience of self-revelation, self-understanding, and self-realization.
Well said again. Absolutely true. So that's the goal. That is really the goal. And I do wish, as I'm sure you do, everyone to proceed in that direction, because the rewards are there for the looking and seeking. So absolutely true. See, we have about 15 more minutes or so. So with that in mind, what other area would you like to go into at the moment?
Well, maybe I could touch on this list of gifts, since, you know, this is supposed to be about the Urantia book. Maybe I could touch on this list of gifts that I started to write out, that the Urantia book has given me, that no other source has given me. I mean, as much as others have and still do provide, I could talk about these different gifts, if that interests you.
Oh, that would be lovely. Please go ahead. Yes.
Okay. So one, the first, and not necessarily the most important, was that it gave me this explanation of creation that I can understand and agree with, because it's so rooted in science and spirituality. You know, it talks about, you know, where we are located, not only in our solar system, but in the grand creation. You know, it gives us perspective from the point of view of, you know, our local universe, our, you know, super universe, and then the grand universe. And so the, you know, the very logical and, you know, coherent, that's the point. It was such a coherent explanation of life that, you know, I couldn't argue with it. I couldn't, it's like, you know, if you don't have some sort of orientation, you could just think that, you know, we're just an accidental life form on this little planet, you know, lost in space. You know, there just wouldn't be any, you know, unifying sense that we belong to we belong in the universe, that we have a role. Even this little planet has a very important role. So that was a gift that, oh my gosh, I know where I am now. I really know where I live now. The next thing that I put down was, it gave me a definition of God, quote unquote, that, you know, I could really not only understand, but relate to. It's like in the past, it's like, well, you know, it was very easy to think that, you know, humankind was just anthropomorphizing, you know, this creative force. And, you know, yes, in my evolution, I thought, well, yeah, okay, there's some sort of intelligence that, you know, fell together and here we are and, you know, we're a life form and, you know, this is happening. But I was never fully convinced that there was a loving, you know, omnipotent, omniscient personality, you know, that it was a person, that it's actually a being that loves and actually even possibly has dimensions of sadness when, you know, it witnesses our struggles and yet is ever there for us. I mean, it was just nothing short of revelation. The next thing was an understanding of the brotherhood of man that spontaneously motivates me to be of service. Like the expression being of service can sort of make my skin crawl, because it sounds like it's sort of like a hair shirt kind of self-flagellating, you know, middle-aged self-sacrificing role. But no, the Urantia book talks about this, you know, this vast evolutionary plan that's going on, Killer, and there's such love at every turn, that to want to share and to want to uplift becomes like the knee-jerk reaction. Like when you have this knowledge, when you read the Urantia book, it's like you literally do want to like start distributing copies from the mountaintop. But, you know, we learn that, you know, people have to have, you know, their own level of interest and motivation to find it. But anyway, it does initiate that natural sense of wanting to share. You just cut me off whenever you need to, Nick.
No, please go ahead.
The next
please
on my list.
I'm glued.
Okay.
I am glued.
thank you. When I actually sit and read the Urantia book, no matter, I mean, I too, as you have shared, have been studying the book since, well, 1970, about 85, 95, 2005, 2000. Well, it's now like going on 45 years. I've been reading the book, but I never tire of it because when I sit and I read the book, my state of consciousness is altered. I mean, right then and there. It's a visceral change. I feel elevated, and I feel in right relation to, you know, my creator and to my to everyone else. It's like I suddenly, you know, feel like I have a perspective that has, you know, literally lifted me. And, you know, so that's why if I do take time to read it in the morning, my day will definitely be better because actual physical and visceral altered state from reading it. let me see.
Well, I got to tell you, Carol, that when I first heard, literally first heard the reading of the Urantia book in the Unitarian Church near where I live, that's exactly what happened to me. It was an absolute amazing experience. I felt instantly that I had found something incredibly important in my life, and it resonated. Mm. It resonated so well and so amazingly with me that I knew I had finally found something very, very important in my life. So I absolutely get what you just said because it happened to me too.
Well, what I love is that it happens to me every time I read the book. It's like it never ceases. It never ceases.
Agreed.
The next point
absolutely.
I had on the list was that unlike all of the other amazing revelations I've read, I mean, I really love the I Am teachings of Saint Germain. They have a very special place in my heart. This new source of Seicho Noie from Dr. Taniguchi is fantastic in its depth. But the Urantia book explains in such a beautiful way the potential relationship between the human being and God. You know, it broke it down, you know, logistically in terms of, in a sense, the vast gulf between a human mortal and God, but it also explained the complete oneness that we can have at any given moment because we have this, you know, in a sense, like a chip in us of God, that we have God within us, and that when I sit and pray and I quiet my mind, and my consciousness is expanded by the sheer, you know, slowing of my thoughts, I feel God. I experience God. And it's, I do not believe it's self-delusional. I believe it's a sense of the presence of God. And I've never felt that encouragement or that, you know, direct connection really elicited in any other path. And so I'm very indebted to the Urantia book for opening that intimate communication I feel with, you know, with God at this point. And I hope to never lose that. I only hope to deepen that. And it's just exactly proportioned to the amount of time I devote to it. Like if I skip my prayer life or my meditation life, you know, my spiritual batteries run low and I start to become more prey to negativity and discouragement and fatigue. If I keep my prayer life active and my meditation, you know, is regular, I feel that nurturance of the relationship with God's presence.
Absolutely agree with that. Absolutely agree 100%. I feel the same way. And it resonates. What you just said absolutely resonates to me. And I'm sure many other readers of the Urantia book also.
Well, I'm so glad. Let me look at my watch. Well, I guess we have a few more minutes. I'll keep going.
We'll try one more, and then we have to go. Hercules, how are we doing?
5 minutes, you should be fine.
Okay. Oh, 5 minutes before we have to leave. All right. Carol, just one more, and then we're going to do a goodbye thing.
Okay. Well, the thing that and there are many, but one more was the Urantia book gives an explanation for why this planet has been somewhat developmentally challenged and delayed. I mean, in some ways, people can feel, what luck to be on a planet that, you know, had a lot of challenges, you know, biologically and evolutionarily. But that explanation, in a sense, is almost like the proper diagnosis, like when you're ailing from something and you go to the doctor and the doctor says, oh, well, it's this. You know how to deal with it. Well, I feel that the Urantia book gives us a very clear diagnosis of what ailed us and, you know, how to remedy the problems. And that was also of great value because it's like, okay. And, you know, complementarily to that, as I mentioned earlier, this vast vision of one day expecting that this planet could enjoy this, you know, ultimate stage of light and life, it gives us, in a sense, time markers. Like, it gives us a sense of what we could anticipate in future epochs, and that it is a very slow process, and that, you know, sometimes there are backward motions, but there are, you know, inevitably it gives us evidence for how much evolution we have gone through and how we have progressed. And so we have reason to have nothing but hope and to just continue with our daily lives progressing as the best we can.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'd like to mention at this point, Carol, that if our listeners would like to contact me or you with a question or a comment, we would welcome that. And you may reach us through my email. I'm going to give you my email address, which is Nick, NYNY1, and that's the numeral 1, not O-N-E, but the numeral 1, @gmail.com. I'm going to repeat it, N-I-C-K. NYNY1 @gmail.com. And Carol, very heartfelt thanks to you for being my guest this evening. It was an absolute true pleasure. And I would love you to consider to return for the very near future to do a part 3. Please do consider that.
Well, you know, you have to see your reader's response first, but I'd be happy to. This has been a joy for me. Just, you know, being prepared for it was, you know, a good experience for me to review. And, you know, I really thank listeners for their patience because it could sound all like Pig Latin. but anyway, thank you so much. And thank you again, Hercules, for hosting us.
Thank you.
Much love to you and to all our listeners. This is Nick Curto presenting the Urantia book. I want to wish you all an enlightened journey. Till next time, please explore the deep wisdom and truly limitless love contained in the Urantia book. Stay safe and be very, very kind to one another. Goodbye for now. Much love to all our listeners and everyone in the world and beyond. Till next time, good night, good night, good night.
Good night. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Harold, you're awesome. This was a great episode. Thanks also to our listeners, whether they called in, whether they clicked on a link and found themselves here, or whether they'll be checking out the show later on demand. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. And we're going to close tonight's show with Michael Duncan's God Bless the World.
God bless the world, God bless the world, God bless the world, God bless the world. God bless the world, God bless the world, God bless the world. God bless the world.
Bless us all.
God bless the world. God bless the world. God bless the world. God bless the world.
Dear Lord, shine your face upon us and bless us, every one of us.
God bless the world.